I'm very pleased to introduce David Rinkensmeyer. There are a couple reasons. One, he just told me he made professor, what, today? Today was And let me put that in perspective. David and I have known each other for 20 years, okay, because he was, when I was a brand new, naive, young, nervous, young faculty member, he was my first student as an undergraduate, and he worked with me then. And the fact he's a professor now sort of puts in perspective how long I've been doing this. Anyway, okay, the second thing I'd like to say is there are at least three faculty, two of whom are here at CMU, who owe their careers to David. I'm one of them. And the reason for that is that David's work as an undergraduate was on memory-based learning. And, you know, basically what got me tenure was, you know, I stood on the shoulders of giants. I, you know, basically said, oh, this work is great. Of course, mine. David's work. And, of course, Andrew Moore, who also is a faculty member here, is his career stems from that work of memory-based learning. And Stefan Schall at USC, also his success or early success is due to work in memory-based learning. So there are a lot of us that you know have a lot to thank you for, and here's your opportunity to talk about after you solve the memory-based learning problem, what did you go on to do next?
Okay, right. Thanks. That's way too generous, by the way, for my contribution to it, but. All right, well, thanks for having me. It's great to be here. And I'm going to show you, I've been working on trying to get robots, build robots that can train people how to move after stroke or spinal cord injury. So I'm going to, first part of the talk, I'll show you some clinical results so far of robot-based therapy. And then here's what we've learned so far. Is that practice is the key stimulus to recovery, and the role of robotic forces remains unclear. So this is my field, but I'm like a skeptic of it that we even need robots to be doing this. So I'll kind of explain that, and then the benefits that we can get by giving people therapy with a robotic device are small and arguably functionally insignificant. So if this is really going to be successful, we have to improve like how much it helps people. And then I'll show you three possible directions for making it more effective that we're doing in my lab. And one is we're getting rid of the robot. So I guess it wouldn't be robot-assisted therapy anymore, but I'll show you how we're trying to do that by having a device that makes the arm just feel like it's floating. And two is we use computational models and motor control, kind of along the lines of what I learned from Chris and at MIT, to optimally, and then we're trying to, what we've been able to figure out is that we can model how human beings are slackers, and I'll show you those kinds of models, and then from that we can just start designing better robot training algorithms, and then we might be able to select better tasks. So really the pioneering work that and the first large clinical test of a robot therapy was with MIT Manus with Neville Hogan and Igo Krebs, and they used a planar two-joint arm, and this thing could assist you in moving your arm on top of a tabletop. And the patient would look at games, like a game where they'd have to move a target into a cursor into a target. And if they couldn't do it, the robot would sort of gently help them do it. And the idea is it would give you some sensory stimulation coupled with your motor output. And that should help in brain reorganization. And then pretty soon after that, at the VA at Palo Alto, they used a MIME arm, Puma robot arm, and one of the novel features was they have this digitizing linkage. So when a person has a stroke, they have one side of the body is paralyzed, and the other side is pretty much normal. There's some deficits, but they can use it pretty well usually. And so here, this person could move their unimpaired arm around, and then this robot would move in a mirror image. So this is a way to specify desired trajectory for the impaired arm. And so mirror image movement enhancer. And then this is a device I built when I was a postdoc at the Rehab Institute of Chicago, Northwestern University. And it was just it's kind of like a trombone. It had a single motor and you could point it in different directions. And we'd ask people to initiate the movement and then we'd finish the movement for them. And so, okay, so here's kind of a summary slide just to get you up to speed on what the results are. And what I plotted here is the Fugelmeier score, which goes from 0 to 66. And 0 is you're completely paralyzed. You can't move your arm at all. And 66 means that you can move normally. And the way this scale is done is you ask, there's 33 questions. And they're things like try to lift your arm like this without bending your elbow, or try to turn your palm over. And then the therapist asks you to do that, and then he or she will grade you 0, you can't do it at all, 1, you can do it, but it's not perfect, and then 2, it's perfect. Okay, so it's a pretty crude scale. But it turns out it does pick up, it is fairly sensitive. And so what I plot here, so when a person has a stroke, they might be pretty low here in the hospital, but they have this period of intrinsic recovery where if you don't do, it's just kind of move normally, don't do any intensive therapy even, they're going to get something back. And so with the rope, so here the first study was one group got training, got their normal therapy. This was with MIT Manus, and they got normal therapy plus another 5 hours per week with the robot. Okay, so they got an additional dose of therapy, and it was robotic therapy, and the robot just assisted them in moving as they played these games. And then the control group here, they just got their normal therapy without the extra dose. Okay, and when you gave that extra, when they gave the extra dose, that you could see they got about 2 or 3 points more on the Fugelmeier, but then at the long-term follow-up, that difference vanished. Okay, so that's what I mean. It's small. There's a benefit there, but it was really small. It was statistic, and this has been confirmed in, I think they've done over maybe 200-300 patients now, maybe more. Okay, and then now you could also do it with someone who had their stroke a long time ago, and so you can bring a person in, and now they're in this flat part of the curve, and you can give them therapy, and you can get a boost up of about 3-4 points. And here's with the MIME robot, they got 5-6 points. Okay, so this part right here defies, actually both of these kind of, if you ask clinicians 20-30 years ago, they would not say either one of these things was possible. Like, no, it's just what you get back is what you get back, and you can't really influence it. And then over here, they would say, well, no, once you've gotten to your plateau, you're not going to get anything back. So we know. So one thing that's good is, and not only with robots, but we started to see that both of those are not right. And in fact, no one, to my knowledge, has done studies where you give a dose here and then wait and another dose and another dose and another dose. So we don't really know what the limits are to this kind of thing. But this involves usually, 5 hours a week for maybe 2 months or something like that. Okay, and then with the arm guide, what I did with that is I had one group of people exercise with the robot, and they'd have to initiate the movement and the robot would finish it. And they'd do, say, 60, 70 movements in an hour period. And then I had a control group, and they would just sit with their hand on their lap, no robot, and they would just reach the same number of times. So I tried a dosage match, okay? And I was trying to get at, do you need the actuator? Do you need the actuator? Is that extra stretching, that sensory stimulation of the brain, is it beneficial? And here's one outcome measure. This is how far you can move, how far you can slide your arm along the device, which is back drivable. And we just laid it horizontal and asked someone to reach. And so you and I would be able to do it really easily, but it's pretty hard. And so there are 3 pre-evaluations and then 3 posts, and then in between 3 and 4, there are 2 months of therapy. So you can see, both groups improved by, 6 centimeters. So it's a significant improvement, but again, small. And then you can see what was interesting is the groups appear almost the same, improved about the same. So that said to me that, it was the dosage that really matters. So practice produces modest but measurable benefits. If you practice 20 hours, you'll get somewhat better recovery results. And you can do it in acute or chronic phase of stroke. But we don't really know that you need the robot. You could have, MIT Manus, you might have just taken the motors off and had the person do the same thing. We don't know. And my study was inconclusive. It was only 20 patients, so it really didn't have power to bound the difference in it. So, and it's only testing one type of robot therapy. So you can't really say the robot's not necessary, but you can say that, that a key element of therapy is how much time is actually spent engaged in trying to move the arm. Okay, so The question is then, you know, how can we improve these results? So this field's kind of exploded. There were, like I was telling Chris, maybe four or five groups, you know, 10, 15 years ago, and now there's, I don't know, there's 20, 30, 40 groups now doing this type of stuff. And so I like, you hear that thing, Edisonian, and so I looked it up and I thought this was interesting. So the history of the light bulb was actually invented in 1801 by an English physician, and he got it to burn for a few minutes. And then a lot of people try to improve it over the next 70 years with not much success. But in 1879, Edison invented a light bulb that lasted 13 hours. And so he was so encouraged by that, that he then sent out his researchers in his lab. They literally went all over the world, and they brought back all types of filament material for him to try. And by the 1 year later, he had gotten it to last 1,200 hours. So that's why, and so that's really what made it practical, and you know, it was a huge improvement. And that's, he's associated with the invention of the light bulb. So the question is, you know, is that going to be the same with this rehab process for people after a stroke? And one thing is that the trial and error approach is very time and resource intensive. So the first multi-site randomized clinical trial that demonstrated a difference between two therapies. This is not robot therapy. It was something called constraint-induced therapy and just normal care. That just happened, and it cost $4 million. And it's the first one that's shown a benefit. So it's very expensive to do this type of clinical testing. And then the other thing is that the destruction of the nervous tissue could just fundamentally limit recovery. So you can imagine you have your actuator and you have your brain, and you have white matter that carries the signal out down to the spinal, through the spinal cord to the muscle. And if you just blow away the white matter, you just don't have enough cable to get signal to the muscle anymore. So we don't know. There might just be fundamental limits on how well someone can recover. All right. But anyway, we're still, you know, trying to improve it. So here's three ways that we're trying to improve it. First, get rid of the robot. Second, we have a robot, but we try to optimize it so that people don't fall asleep and slack, and maybe select better tasks. Okay, so to get rid of the robot, and this is with Robert Sanchez, who was a PhD student of mine, and Sarah Hausman, who's a really great occupational therapist, we're working with the Rehab Institute of Chicago. So if you know, we know practice is key, what limits a patient's ability to practice? A major factor is weakness decreases motivation. So gravity is a threshold, so if I can't exert enough force to lift the weight of my arm, I could, you know, if I can't get my arm off at the table, then I can't practice moving. So people are actually that weak, and even though they can exert some force, they can't exert enough force to start moving, and they stop practicing, and then it's thought that there's disuse-related processes in your brain that then make it so, you know, if you don't use it, you lose it. You even get worse at moving. So therapists have recognized that for a long time. So the therapist will actually manually assist you in moving, active assist exercise. It's flexible, but it's gotten more and more expensive. And so we have this paradox in rehab now where more therapy is better, right? Scientific studies are showing more therapy is better, and yet at the same time, patients are getting less therapy because of the constraints on the healthcare system. So a strange paradox. And then so then we can also do robots. It's a powerful scientific tool, but you know, is that really clinically necessary? And then passive arm supports are widely used but boring. And so here's kind of what's done in the clinic. You have these things like a Swedish sling, which is a counterbalanced or spring with springs or weights, skateboards, mobile arm supports that you could buy. And then this is the most common thing, which is you just use a table and put a towel, and it kind of removes friction, and the person just practices moving the arm. So the thing with all these some of them are hard to set up, like these two. And then this one's kind of doesn't work that well. It has a lot of friction. This is the simplest. People end up using that, but it's just really boring for the patient. So we said, well, you know, can we do better? So we said, let's try to make a passive, non-robotic device that gives you a large 3D workspace, gives adjustable weight support, and integrated grip sensing. So people, even if they just have a really weak grasp, we wanted them to be able to start using that to try to get better. And then we do simple virtual reality. And so we saw an exoskeleton built by Tarek Rahman called Rex, which is Wilmington Robotic Exoskeleton, which is it's misnamed because it never became robotic. It worked so well with the rubber bands, they didn't put actuators on it. But It's this, and it uses two four-bar mechanisms, and it's kind of like an architect's lamp. And you can add rubber bands, and it makes the arm feel like it's floating. And so we scaled it up, made it a lot stronger, because stroke patients that would break it. They've had these uncoordinated motions, and they'd break it. So we had to make it a lot stronger. And then made sensors on it. And then so we made these games. I want to let this video run. So here's just showing, it's free to move. This is Sarah Hausman, the OT that I work with, the occupational therapist. And so she can set it up. You can change the lengths. That takes a little bit of time. And then the person puts their arm in, and they'll play a game like this one, which is the shopping game, which they have to reach up for an object, and then they have to squeeze to grab the object. It'll attach to their hand here. And then they have to bring it to the shopping cart and then release. And that release motion is actually the hardest thing for a stroke patient. They can usually squeeze a little bit, but to release is really hard. And so practice on grasp and release and then coordinated arm movement. So here she's putting the rubber bands on, and then he's playing a game. Just get a feel for the type. So he's not it won't give you your full range of motion, but you can get some range of motion and start practicing again. So we've done kind of three studies with it, and the first thing I'll show you is, does it really allow you to have a greater range of motion? And the answer there is, here's an example. So here we ask people to draw a circle like this. And this is, I think, interesting scientifically, so you draw a circle like this, and you can see they're in the exoskeleton, but they don't have any gravity support for their arm, and their hand just drops down, and he can catch it, and he catches it a little earlier if we give him practice. And then here we give the gravity support and ask him to draw a circle, and this is a guy who hasn't made this motion in eight years. He had a stroke 8 years ago, so hasn't done it. So it's interesting to me that, after, and not too bad, the first one, and 30 tries later, he's making a pretty good circle. So you have that planning capacity still, and it's something like you just can't get the signals out to make the motion, but at least this device lets you start making it. So then we did a pilot study, and we did people came in. This was five people, and here's what we found. These are chronic people, and we let them go, and they improved by about 5 or 6 points. So it's about the same as the robotic stuff. And this is showing that they were able to reach about 10% farther. This is how far they could reach without arm support over the 25 sessions or 25 days, and that improved. Okay, and then the phase three testing, we're doing a randomized trial at RIC, and we're comparing it. Now we say, well, if you do the T-Rex, is that better than doing this tabletop types, this typical stuff? So it's usually, we want to do something. So here's the idea. We want a piece of technology that the patient could use without having the therapist there all the time. Okay, and so we want to compare it to what in a clinic can you do right now? What's the best that you could do, or kind of what's the standard right now in the clinic? And this is the standard. So the therapist will give you a book of exercises. You'll get some pages like this with pictures. And then she'll work with you the first couple sessions. And then you'll come in, she'll set you up, and then you'll work through it for an hour. And she'll give you help every once in a while. And so we wanted to compare it to that. And what we're finding in this study here, this is Fugelmeier, the change in Fugelmeier with training. And I put the T-Rex versus conventional therapy, which is the tabletop and towel, versus MIT Manus MIME and another robot, Gentle S. So you can see they're all about the same. And T-Rex is a little bit better than conventional and a little worse than MIME. And people are actually, you can ask them, how much are you using your arm? And people are using their arm nearly significantly more after doing the therapy. And then we let both groups try the other therapy. Okay, so we say the group that did the T-Rex, therapy Rex, they then try the tabletop for 1 day. And the tabletop gets to try the T-Rex for 1 day. And then we say, well, which do you think would, we ask about 10 questions. Which would you recommend? Which is more beneficial? Which is less worrying? Which would you prefer? And they're, it's pretty strongly in the favor of T-Rex. About 80% of them choose the T-Rex. So at the least, we feel like we've created something that's like can give comparable effectiveness to the clinical standard, but be much more interesting and therefore more likely to be used by the patient. So that one's gonna, hopefully it's going to get commercialized. A company called Hokama is making a version of it that is much quicker to adjust all the settings on, so you could use it in the clinic. All right, so that's kind of my really applied practical attempt to make something that could be used in the clinic. And then now we're also trying to now to be kind of more scientific and say, well, how does the brain learn, and how could you design robot therapy to enhance brain, you know, enhance learning? So in there we said, well, let's start with something we can kind of model and handle, which is let's look at a motor adaptation task that you can study in like a one session, not something you have to do over 2 months. So we built this robot here. I can show you a video I pulled down called Arthur. And we looked at it to build it. We're interested in walking too. So we wanted to make a robot where we could measure and perturb walking. So it's a linear motor. It's a magnet way with coils up here, and you can control the force on these two coils. And then there it was just in a back drive mode, and now we're replaying what we measured. And then it shows it's got pretty high bandwidth. Like I think it could get up to like 8 or 10 hertz, you know, in making a circle like that. Okay. So, all right, so we said now let's perturb a person. What am I doing wrong here?
Right, just go to show.
There you go. All right, so we took this paradigm that was kind of developed by Shadmer and Musavaldi to look at reaching motions. But so we had people walk and we want to look at learning here. Okay, so people are walking. This is their stepping trajectory measured at their ankle. And we apply a force field to them with the robot. And the force field, it pushes up with the force proportional to the forward velocity of their leg. Okay, so when you do that, they step high. Okay, and now the instruction to the subject is just try to walk normally. So when you say that, then after a few steps, they'll start coming back toward their normal step. Okay, and then when you turn the force field off unexpectedly, they show an after effect, which is the pink trace here. And so they step low, abnormally low. So if you plot the step height, a reference to a normal step height, you see here's, they're walking along, you know, the 10th step, we turn it on, they have a big direct effect, they step high, now you can see the learning curve here. They come back, not all the way to their normal step height, but somewhat close. And then here we turn the field off and they have an after effect, and interestingly, it takes you a while to learn how to walk again after you've perturbed someone like this. So the fact that you have this after effect says that you formed some sort of prediction about the force field. And in fact, your brain, and people will say you formed an internal model of the force field. You learned how to predict what was going to happen. Okay, so what we found, so we said, well, how can we model this process? And we had the hypothesis that when people, kind of from an evolutionary perspective, what would make sense is that people try to minimize their effort. So U would be muscle force here, and this is a cost function. And then XI minus XD, that would be the change in step height. So you want to minimize your kinematic error, but also you want to minimize your effort. Okay, so if you take a cost function like that, and then you say you're going to minimize it in a greedy fashion, and you take the dynamics of the leg and the robot, you get, this is the controller you get for the human. Okay, and this fits the data really well. So going back here, that type of model fits this well. Okay, it fits it pretty accurately. Now, look at what this controller is. So what this is saying is the muscle force on the next step. So what am I going to do on my next step? This is how much force I'm going to apply to resist the force field. It's going to be equal to the force on the previous step times this F, which is a forgetting, or I'm preferring to call it a slacking factor now, minus an error-based kind of learning term, so a gain times an error. Okay, so this is kind of error-based learning with slacking. So the interesting thing about this was the slacking. So we could identify this, and this F, it turns out, is around 0.8 for this task. So think about what that means. So if if xi equals xd, so the stepping error is small, then you're going to exponentially decrease the force that you're trying to put out. Okay, so that's what we call slacking. So when your errors are small, people always try to do less the next time. Okay, and this predicts really well. So I said, notice in this picture that people do not return all the way to the baseline here. And in fact, we could change the strength of the field that they had to adapt to, and then we could plot, you know, the size of the final error versus the predicted final error from this type of model, because this model predicts that it'll increase with the field strength, and you can see they're really well correlated. Okay, so then we get this picture. So humans are slackers. Okay, they're error-based learners with slacking. So how might you learn that to enhance learning? How might you use that information to enhance learning? So one thing we tried was, well, look, if learning is error-based, then to make someone learn faster, just make the errors bigger. And if you make them bigger transiently, you could make someone learn faster. And so, and this is equivalent to a one-step-ahead control in a control theory. It's a type of one-step-ahead control. And so what we did is we would turn on the force field, and we could calculate, like, we can make it abnormally strong just for one step. That's this red line here. And if we do that, you see then the red lines come faster back to the toward the baseline. So we could speed up learning by about 30% or something. So just kind of a proof of point. I don't know if it's practical, but it is kind of everyone has been designing robots that sort of assist people in doing the task, make their errors smaller. And this, and then work by Jim Patton, and then Bambi Brewer here, had some data that kind of implies the same thing. If you make the errors larger, somehow people might kind of provoke plasticity better than if assisting someone. Okay, and then now what if, but some tasks you do want to assist. Okay, so for walking is a good example. So if you can't walk, you won't practice walking. So the rationale there is you got to assist someone with parallel bars or a walker, some body weight support, so they can at least begin practicing. So if you're going to do that, well, what would be a wise way to do it? So then we said, well, look, we can express the desire to assist as needed. We can express that as an optimization problem. So we can say, look, from the robot, what do we want the robot to do? So just create a cost function just like the human. We want the robot to make the kinematic error small, but we also want it to minimize its own force, its assistance force. Okay, and so when you do that, you get the robot control law becomes something that looks like this. So it kind of mimics the human. And then here's an experiment kind of showing this at work. So this is a person was exposed to the force field three times. So here's the first time you turn it on, they learn, turn it off, they have an after effect. Okay. Now the second time we expose them to the force field, we turn on the virtual robot trainer, which is this assist as needed trainer, and it essentially counteracts the action of the force field, but because it has an error-based turn, it gradually lets the person experience more and more of the force field based on how much error they have. And so you can see, without ever having this large error, then by the time we get out here and we turn the force field off, the person shows after effects. So the robot force just basically exponentially decreased in this time period, the assistance force. And so we could get learning without large errors. And that's kind of what you want in a gait training situation. Like the person's walking, but they're not coming to rely on the robot. And then we did it one more time just to prove this wasn't a time, you know, turn it on without assistance, and the person has the big direct effect. All right, so that's all great, except this is a complete toy task, and we actually would like to help people with their therapy, and this is not therapy, this is just walking with a robot perturbing you. Okay, so we've started applying that to rehabilitation, and we're doing it, we kind of done it with the arm and with the leg. And so this is very recent stuff. All right, so we'd like to use the robot to provide active assistance so the person can repetitively practice the desired motion. We want them to be able to practice a lot. Practice is good, so you want them to practice. But if the robot assists too much, the person may slack, and this may potentially decrease their learning because they have less engagement, less descending activation. So, and then if the robot assists too little, the person won't be able to do the task. So this would, again, they become frustrated and might not, you know, want to do it. So the solution is to make the robot a slacker. All right, so we took the T-Rex and we actuated it with pneumatic cylinders. And this is work with Jim Bobrow. Actually, a lot of this work is with Jim Bobrow, the optimization stuff and Jim's just a really excellent control engineer, both in building hardware and doing the control theory. So we use pneumatics, and it's a highly compliant robot. So here, let me play a video. So by using airs, you know, spongy, so the robot, we had this kind of constraint that the whole thing was going to be compliant. So here's a person doing therapy. She's playing the shopping game. She's reaching out for items and putting them in the shopping cart. Okay. And so you can see some variability in her reaching, and we think that's because the robot's compliant. So we think that causal relationship is really important because it maintains, you know, if the patient deviates their motor command, then the way the robot moves deviates. And so the patient feels in control. And now, okay, but how do you make a compliant robot help you move a limb against gravity? And so there you have to use some sort of, you know, one way is to use some feed forward. And so Jim Bobrow and Eric Wolberg came up with using an adaptive control algorithm to form a real-time computer model of the forces that you need to assist the person. Okay? And so that's what was happening in this video. And then this video is what happens when we turn the robot. This is when she's not getting assistance. And she's trying to reach up here to the object and she can't get it. Okay, so she had done the T-Rex study and without the actuators, and she came in and to test the new Rex. This is our first time to test it. And she was like, wow, you know, I've really gotten a lot better. You know, and she really, in this video here, she really thought that she was doing all the motion. And we think it's because the robot was so compliant. Like, she felt in control because she could influence what was happening. And so then when we did this and said we turn off the assistance and this happened, then she actually, you know, it's depressing. We're all depressed. But in a way, we're happy in a weird way because we feel like we had achieved what we were trying to do. But she, yes, it was depressing that she really hadn't gotten that much better. Okay, so now here's the basic story now. So if we take the standard adaptive controller from the literature and we have it build up this model, it uses radial basis functions and builds up a model of the weakness. If we do that, the person is smart enough to realize that they're attached to an adaptive controller that will take over the movement for them, and the person slacks and lets the robot take over. Okay? So what we had to do is modify the adaptive controller with a slacking term, the exact same type of slacking rate. And when we do that and you set the slacking rate low enough for the robot, then the person does more effort. And so that's what this plot shows. So here's three different subjects. Each column is a subject. Mildly impaired subject, moderately impaired, severely impaired. Now this task, they're reaching out to targets like this, and we're showing the trajectories that they reach with. Okay, so this person can get all the targets. This person has this is left arm, so they have a really hard time going out like this, which is really common for people with a stroke to try to get their arm out like that. She can't get, and this person can, you know, she's hitting the robot hard stop down here. Okay, so now these two plots show when the robot's assisting. And in one case, the robot has no forgetting, which is down here. And then in this case, the robot has forgetting up here, which is, this is the forgetting time constant. So tau of infinity means no forgetting or no slacking. And so first thing to notice is the kinematics of the motions, they look very similar. They're getting the targets. You notice that they're curved and they have noise in them. And we think that's a really good thing, you know, because people are seeing cause and effect as they move. Now the red bars are how much force the robot used to assist the person on average. So you can see that when it had slacking, it used significantly less force. Well, you can't tell significance here, but it used less force than when it didn't have slacking. So we can, you know, another way to look at it is here. Here, this is the amount of force. The person's tracking two targets back and forth like this, and this is the amount of force the robot's using to support the arm. And we do two experiments. One is we let the person start with their arm relaxed, so the person's arm weighs about 50 newtons here. And then we say, okay, now you try to do the task. Or we just say, do the task from the beginning. And if you look at the light gray lines, that's when there's no forgetting. And you can see whether they start from the beginning doing it all themselves or whether they start from their arm relaxed, these gray lines come up here way higher than the black lines. So the robot ends up doing much more of the task than the person. Or much more of the task than if you incorporate the slacking. So just focus here. One more way to look at it, and this is kind of the statistical. So here's the, for an unimpaired subjects, here's how much tracking error they have in doing this tracking task back and forth. Lift your arm and track between two targets. So they have very little tracking error with and without the forgetting factor, but the amount of force that the robot's applying to assist is either 100%, so the robot's doing it almost all for you, or none. So anyway, so I'm pretty excited about this because this to me is like what robot therapy is about. Like now we have a way to actually compare, does effort matter in rehabilitation therapy? So we have they can be in one group of people be in the robot with no slacking factor, one in the robot with the slacking factor. They're going to have the exact same kinematics, make the exact same number of motions, but one group is going to like slack off and do less effort, and one group's going to do more effort. So that I'll tell you in about 2 years whether whether that we find a difference there. Now we have done two subjects already, and I just put them here. They both participated in the T-Rex, so I added their data, and they both went up by another 3 or 4 points on the. So this kind of shows you, and you know, it seems like, hey, why not? You know, if you could get a robot in a home or a gymnasium that people could use, and they could come to regularly, maybe they could actually get bigger jumps off this curb than if you just do 2 months at a time. Okay, so. All right, so the third point was people in this robot therapy, they've just taken robots and just thrown it at the problem. And they've said, you know, any task, walking, reaching, whatever, hand opening, we're just going to make a robot, an exoskeleton, and it's going to help you do the task. Well, could it be that there are just certain tasks that are more suited for assistance? Like, you know, maybe robot assistance isn't a cure-all for motor learning, but maybe there's specific things that it's valuable for. So robot-assisted motor training, it's in the motor learning literature, it would be called something called guidance. And there's something called the guidance hypothesis, which says that if you guide people as they try to learn, you give too much guidance, then they don't learn. And we know that there's five or 10 papers in the literature that show that kind of thing for kind of simple motor tasks. So we said, well, maybe, you know, are there tasks that might be more amenable to guidance? And two things we came up with were, well, what if you had to learn a complex motion? Okay, or the second thing is, what if you had to learn a timing task? So the first one was complex motion. So we had people grab a phantom, and they would learn two different ways here. These are non-disabled subjects. And they'd either learn by holding the robot, and the robot would move through a trajectory. It's this kind of weird coil shape here that we wanted them to learn. And they would learn through, they would move through, and they had to move along with the robot. So, and they're watching it. So they're getting motor output, and they're getting haptic information about the path. And we compared that to a group of people who just sat, and the robot would just move through the trajectory, and then they'd watch it. You know, they'd just watch it, okay? And so the paradigm was they'd watch it for, I think, 7 movements, and then they'd try to do it for 7 movements. And then they'd watch it for 7 movements and try to do it for 7. Or they'd feel it for 7, try to do it for 7. And what we found is you could get better at this tracing, but it was actually, if you had they're pretty much the same. Pretty much the same. So I don't, you know, so they talk about these mirror neurons in your brain that you just, if you watch a football game, then these neurons go active just like if you were playing football. So maybe that's the system responsible for this. But that, so robots no good there, no good for there, that one. And then, okay, so then we said, what about this one, which is learning to drive? Okay, and so here, you know, we had people drive it was actually a simulation of a wheelchair, and which I'll explain in a second why we did that, but virtual simulation, and we had a force feedback steering wheel, and we wanted them to learn to drive on this path. And the chair's going pretty fast, and the turns are pretty sharp. And so we tried three strategies. One group learned with no guidance, so the joystick was just freely moving, or the steering wheel was freely moving. One group learned with control games that did the assistance as needed. The error base was slacking. And so essentially, they exponentially the stiffness of the steering wheel exponentially decreased with time. Each trial here is about a minute long. And then the other group got fixed guidance. So the steering wheel just always showed you what you should be doing. And Laura Marshall, the student here, was able to work out like a really good look-ahead steering control algorithm that would steer better than a human could. So you could hold onto the steering wheel, and if you just kind of went along with it, you'd steer very well. And what we found was when you didn't apply any guidance, this is the tracking error. And so you have a big tracking error to start, and then you learn. Okay, this is the normal learning curve with no guidance. Now, when you apply guidance, which are these other two curves, you don't have as big of errors. Now, the key point here is at trial 20, and trial 20 is the point where we turn off the guidance. Okay, so now you can say, did the person learn anything? And you can see out here, yes, you turn it off, and they have much smaller errors. But what's interesting is you turn off the fixed guidance one, and they actually have a significant increase in their error, which so then over the next 5 or 10 training segments, they can get rid of. So this team to say to us, I think this is really the first proof that assistance as needed can help you learn something better than no guidance or guidance. So and it actually, you can see this black line is actually lower than the no guidance condition. So what we wondered about that, and what we did was we plot how far ahead the person was initiating their turn in front of the turn, in front of the curve, versus what their tracking error was. And this asterisk here is the optimized robot controller. So this is just the joystick or the steering wheel just doing it by itself. And so you could get it initiates the turn really early, and it gets really small errors. Okay, and then we compared the groups that this big triangle here is the mean of never receiving any guidance, and then these are the ones that receive guidance, training with guidance. And we found that the ones who had training with guidance tended to initiate their turns earlier, so a longer distance in front of, a bigger distance in front of the turn. So it's as if they learned something from the robot. They, yeah, go ahead.
How far ahead did your robot look
ahead? The exact number you mean, or I don't remember what the exact number. Yeah, it's different than this number, but I don't know. I don't remember what it was exactly. It also depends on the speed that you program the wheelchair to go at. So anyway, this to me again, I think it's like the first evidence that you know people could actually learn something by haptic. Now you could probably also just say give a buzzer and say, hey, start your turn now. You know, people could probably learn that way. The advantage of the using this force feedback steering wheel is that they always have smaller errors. And why would that be important? Well, if you're learning to fly a real plane, or the application we have in mind is this, where you take a child who's about 2 years old, and mobility is really important for a kid to develop socially and cognitively. They have to be able to interact with their environment. So if a kid with severe cerebral palsy and they can't move at all, they want to get the kids in the wheelchair as early as possible to get them moving. So 2 years old, 3 years old. So the way they do it is the therapist walks beside the wheelchair hand over hand. And so it says, you know, okay, we're gonna go over there, and then she kind of walks by and helps the child steer. And it's very labor intensive and very expensive. So we said, well, why not replace this joystick with a force feedback joystick and then use the assistance as needed algorithm. And then we have the chair, we can lay down a line on the floor and the chair can track the line. And then we can assist as needed to bring the child back to the line. So that's we'd like to do that. We don't have funding for that, but we're still kind of going on for it. I think it could be a really neat thing. Anyway, so guidance might be important for tasks for which timing is important. If like guidance, you think about like help guiding someone physically, you basically screw up the dynamics of the task for them. You know, so if they're trying to learn, like, oh, this force produces this motion, and they've got this big robot attached to them that's, like, totally changing the dynamics, they're not learning anything about the dynamics. You know, they can see a kinematic path, but they're not learning the dynamics. So we think guidance is bad for learning dynamics, but for timing, it might be okay. Think about this task, like, you basically come up to a curve, and then the thing just turns on and moves you. It's like kind of like a Bang Bang, or all you know, a big burst of, and it just says now, just do it now, and do the most that you can right now. And so we think for that type of task, maybe like playing pinball, for example, like guidance might be good, or maybe like tennis or hitting balls. Okay, so then I was just going to finish with, we also are doing this with gait training, and so this is the Locomat, and this is, they've sold about 100 of these. It's a Swiss device, and it can move your hip and your knee, and it has a passive mechanism so you can kind of bounce up and down. And but it's stiff. It's real stiff. And so it looks useful, but it looks like it's about as half as effective as if the therapist are assisting you in doing training. Okay. And so we've been trying with Jim Bobro and Susie Harkema at UCLA. This is Daisuke, who's a grad student who built it. We made a compliant robot that can help you walk. And so let me show a few of these videos here. So I'll show you first this. So the science for this, it comes from rats and cats, animal models. So this is an animal with a complete spinal cord transection. And this animal, if you put it in the cage, it'll drag its hind limbs. But if you provide some body weight support and put on a treadmill, you can see it can start getting a pretty fine stepping pattern. So that's been studied for about 100 years. But what's been kind of discovered in the last 10 or 20 years is that if you do this type of training, make it a training technique, then the animal will actually get better at stepping. Okay, so that says that some of the control circuitry for controlling walking in a human is actually in the spinal cord, and it's plastic. It can learn. So we built this robot to be able to study that in lab models. And here the robot linkages were just passive, but we can make assist the rat if we want, or resist it. All right, so that type of training is applied to human patients. So here's what the training looks like for human patients, where it takes three therapists, one at the pelvis and one on each leg, and then they try to assist as needed in producing a stepping pattern. This is from Susie Harkema's lab at UCLA. She's in Kentucky now, University of Louisville. But this is a guy with a spinal cord injury. So what we did was we made this pelvic robot that has 6 degrees of freedom, and it can actuate 5 of those. And so it can be operated in a zero force control mode, so it can just measure motion. Then we have these leg actuators to help. And so I'll replay this, but you can see the therapist back here was able to just stop because the robot was doing exactly, and here you can see him sag when the robot turns off. So. Yeah, so initially here it's just measuring the motion, and then we can measure it, record it, and average it, and then at some point, I think it's about right here, the robot turns on. Yeah, now they're able then to just do less work and just help with preventing the toe from dragging and do fine placement. So we could get it down to 2 therapists, and then the therapists aren't doing nearly as labor-intensive work. And we had a lot of problems with the leg interfaces, so we've been The pelvic part works really well, but the leg interfaces we've been trying to improve on. And then let's see. Yeah. Anyway, I'll just play one more, I guess. So here's one more. So what we found was since the robot's compliant, people get out of synchronization with it really easily. Even if we've recorded their, so Daisuke Ayaga came up with a algorithm that looks at the state of the robot. So it's got these 6 actuators, position and velocity for each of those, and compares it to the state that you want to be at, and then it either accelerates or decelerates the replay time. So it's kind of like adding compliance in the temporal dimension. And by doing that, you know, people can walk slower or walk faster, and the robot stays in synchronization with them. So this is replay without subject. And then.
How noisy is that?
It sounds like this. It goes. So we have filters on the, they're proportional servo valves, so they don't click. And then we have filters on the output, so it's pretty tolerable, yeah. But it takes a lot of air. Yeah, the servo valves, I think it's they're leaking through the servo valves leak a lot, so. In here, I'll show you the original. Oh no, I don't think I can play this. Oh well, it was originally a senior design project, and I show you the very first prototype. You can look at my website, but it lifts me up and moves me around, so that's kind of funny. All right, so that. So just to conclude then, all right, anyway, so robot-assisted therapy, I'm kind of a skeptic, but I'm hopeful that we can be Edisonian, and those are some of the ideas for improving it. So, all right, thanks a lot.
Questions, comments?
Yeah. Have you looked specifically at improvements in spasticity with this?
I did with the arm guide, the very first trombone thing, and I didn't see any changes. And we would do stretches on the arm and look at reflex stiffness. I didn't see very large changes with that. I think for stroke, the spasticity, it's a real problem for a minority of the, I mean, a lot of people have it, but I don't think it creates like the spastic restraint thing, I think is only a big problem for a small percentage. And there's some papers that kind of support that. Yeah.
So what are the chances that you can make something cheap enough that somebody could have it in their home over the long term and then, you know, give it back when they don't?
You know, the pneumatics are actually pretty cheap. Like, it's about $1,000 per degree of freedom. The cylinders are about, they have a linear pod on them, they're $350. And the valves are about $300 or $400. So the pneumatic stuff is actually, and then you need a compressor. If you get a noisy one, they're like $200, you know, they're really cheap. So the pneumatics could have an advantage of being pretty inexpensive. I don't know, the home stuff, it seems to me more limiting is the safety. The issue is like, would you really want a robot that could sort of run into you and, you know, just working out the whole how someone could use this thing at home safely is tricky, I think. So I think what's going to happen is we'll see more of these things getting into the clinic, and then therapists will get more comfortable with using them, and they'll start being integrated. And then like maybe 5-10 years from now, when therapists say, like, you know, I've used this thing for 5 years and it's never had a problem, and then people, they're going to, you know, and the people, it'll probably be like a lease model. You know, and the numbers are there. I mean, that's why there's a lot of people interested in this, because the stroke is like, there's about 3 to 4 million people in the U.S. who have had a stroke, and it's about 700,000 people new per year. So that's a big, that's one, you know, 3 million people in the U.S., that's 1 out of every 100 people in the U.S. has had a stroke. And those numbers are just going to go up, because age is a risk factor for stroke. The U.S. population is aging. And we're getting better at acute care for stroke. So people survive their strokes at much higher rates now. Right. So more, you know, so from a business point of view, there's a huge market possible, but no one's been able to figure out, like, well, like you see the value of the robot isn't like so obvious yet that you'll take it instead of using a towel. Yeah, no one's been able to sort of.
Well, I think more critically, somebody typically, an insurance company has to pay for it, and they won't do that until there's a very obvious large benefit.
Right. So if you could show, like, hey, if a person does this every day, then, you know, it reduces the risk of them having a shoulder surgery in 10 years, you know, something like, you know, long-term preventative care. But you see, that's another thing with the person with a stroke is they have one good side. So, you know, people can eat. They don't need an attendant to help them eat or, you know, toilet or whatever. They have one good side. So it really is a quality of life issue, this type of therapy. Because, you know, of course, you ask the person, of course they want their dead arm to come back to life. But, you know, I have a friend, Derek Camper. He likes to say that we can do more for a person who's lost their arm than we can do for someone who still has their arm and has had a stroke, you know, which is an interesting thing. So, yeah.
So, do you try experiments with people with cerebellum strokes?
No, I haven't. I've never done anything with cerebellum strokes. There are some groups that focus in on cerebellar type stuff, on this type of robotic stuff, but I've never done that.
Any other questions?
Yeah. was the Kugelmeier graph that you showed in the beginning with the Mitmanis, was that when you had the little bit of the larger hump for the robot, were they actually getting 5 hours more of therapy a week, or was it just, was the control group getting that, also getting that 5 hours?
No. Yeah, the control group got a different dose of therapy.
So is it possible that it wasn't the robot, but just the fact they were getting more therapy?
That's what I think. Yeah. I think it was more therapy. And the robot's a convenient way to do that. But I think that they could have turned the robot motors off and had the person get the same benefit. I don't know. No one's done that study yet. But then you start getting into psychology, because if you turn the robot motors off, then people just might be, it's just so frustrating to do it. They might just not do it. So there's this whole, that whole social side of it too, where the technology might have value just because it's like more fun, you know, it's more interesting. So. Yeah.
So, in some disabilities, you see this issue of getting started, getting the movement started. You get a little bit of a nudge, and you start doing. So, Parkinson's, for example. So, you might see some. I'm wondering if there might be some parallels with this notion of trying to kind of get the person to start that motion, and then back them on as they start getting better at it.
Yeah. Yeah, and I hadn't thought about that. I was talking to Bambi Brewer, and she made the connection with brain-computer interfaces, where the monkey realizes that it can stop moving its arm and still control the cursor. I don't know if you guys know that work, but electrodes on the brain, and the monkey's moving. You have an algorithm that learns to map the neural activity to the motion, then you switch the control over from the actual motion on the arm to the brain control movement. And the monkey then figures out that, hey, look, I don't have to move my arm. And that to me seems like a perfect slacking example. It'd be actually interesting to see if there's sort of a time constant to that. You know, how that actually works. You know, they're doing this, and then they do this, and then nothing. As an assessment. Yeah, I mean, that no one's really gotten there yet, but it does seem like you could use the amount of assistance the robot provides to you as an assessment of the severity of the disability. And, yeah.
And then the force feedback steering wheel could be at somebody's house.
Oh, yeah, that could be, yeah.
Yeah, I guess I was thinking, I know you did some work with mice.
Oh, with a joint, yeah, I did a force, yeah. I didn't even talk about that, but we had a grant from Microsoft to use Microsoft technology for helping people with disabilities. And they had a force feedback joystick you can get at Circuit City or whatever for $50-$60. And so we had a web-based system, and we did MIT Manus exercises, where they would have to move to target, and then the joystick would turn on and help you do it. But people really liked it. They liked, some fraction of people we tried it with really liked it, but what we found is they got better at doing joystick motions. Okay, so you kind of get this idea of specificity of learning, so you get better at the thing you practice. So we set, so then that's why we wanted to have something that allowed larger arm motion, so that you could practice eating or washing. A big one is washing your other arm, something like that. So. Well, everyone talks about in the rehab field, the Wii, looks just ideal, But when I talk to a therapist about Wii, it's, they say it's kind of too hard for patients. They're too impaired to actually do it. So if you could sort of come up with ways, clever, low-cost robots or passive mechanisms that allow people to interact with Wii, I think that could be something that people could use at home. Yeah, and it's engaging. It's large motions, and yeah, and there you're tapping into the gaming market's so huge it brings the cost of the technology way down. So.
Any other questions, comments?
Yeah.
A lot of what you're talking about is people feeling positive about being able to do something themselves and the psychology of that helping them do it better. How do you think that compares with the feedback distortion stuff that some research has been going on?
Oh, Well, that, I think the feedback distortion, I think, might be able to be linked to the slacking thing, too, it seems like. It's almost like you're increasing error, and that sort of overcomes people's tendency to do less, to do kind of the less to be successful. So, but, yeah, I was saying to Chris, I mean, as a, you know, I'm an engineer and do robotics, and you tend to think about kinematics and dynamics, and but then as you start getting in, it's like, You want to say something like, well, it might just be psychology where they'll use it more. But you know, I don't want to diminish that because the psychology could be actually kind of the more defining and important thing in this area. It's like, you know, figuring out what it, so now we're calling people back and asking them, you know, what is it about this that you really liked better? We're trying to narrow in, was it the fact that you have some arm support so you could move your arm? Was it the fact that you could grip? You know, and do some gripping. What, did you really like the games? Did you, you know, what? You know, we're trying to zero in what aspect of the technology it was that they like. So.
The feedback distortion is like it almost seems like it would be it would make people frustrated because it's like they're trying to do something and the distortion is telling them that they're not doing it.
Yeah. What happened? Yeah. I mean, we try actually with the T-Rex. This one we try. We're doing something similar where we. We kind of took the lead, followed Yoki and Bambi's lead there, where we scale the range of motion on the screen to their ability to do the task. So we say we want to make the task difficult but doable. So if they're successful in getting all the shopping items, then we make it so they have to move in a little bit wider workspace next time compared to, you know, what's on the screen. So it's a way of doing assistance as needed also. So.
All righty, well, thank you. Speaker, and thank you. All
right, thanks a lot.
So the key thing you need to do is take your microphone off.